Hello and welcome to Crossing Channels. I'm Rory Catlin-Jones. Can governments regulate AI without stifling innovation? That's the subject of the latest in our podcast collaboration between Cambridge University's Bennett Institute for Public Policy and the Institute for Advanced Study in Toulouse. As ever, we're going to use the interdisciplinary strengths of both institutions to explore a complex challenge. Is there an inherent trade-off between regulation and innovation? Can regulation move fast enough to protect citizens from the harms of innovations? And can nations competing for AI supremacy really collaborate to slow down dangerous developments? To explore these issues today, we have Verity Harding from the Bennett Institute. Verity, start us off. What does your research focus on?
My research looks at the history of transformative technologies and what the regulation of those technologies can teach us about the future of AI.
And joining us from Cambridge University's Mindaroo Centre for Technology and Democracy, we have Gina Neff, who is the Executive Director of the Centre. Gina, could you share with us your primary research interests?
We look at how to make digital technologies work for people, communities, and societies, with a particular focus on sustainability and the future of work.
And from the IAST and the University of Rochester, we have Lawrence Rothenberg. Take us through your research interests, Lawrence.
Yes, I do work in political economy. I run an Institute for Political Economy here at Rochester, doing various work on regulation and sustainability as well.
Well, let's begin with assessing just how AI regulation is proceeding and what the risks are that regulators are addressing. How do the US, UK and the EU differ in their approaches? Big question. Verity Harding, why don't you start us off?
Well, I think the US and the UK are kind of similar to each other and different from the EU. And the reason for that is the EU has decided to already pass some legislation when it comes to AI. Whereas what the UK and the US have done is said, look, this is too early. We're going to set sort of guidelines and principles. We're going to ask, in the case of the US, for voluntary commitments from the makers of large language models as relates to safety. And in the UK, they've set a series of principles and sent those to existing regulators and said, when you come across AI in your existing normal line of business, these are the principles you should be looking out for. That's different to the EU, who have said, we're actually going to introduce legislation. It's already passed the EU AI Act, and it was negotiated and discussed over many months and years, actually. And they've said there are some areas in AI that already need to be banned. A very small number, but they have said there's a set of things that are unacceptably risky and will be banned. Then there are another set of things within AI that are high risk and we need to put measures in place and so on from there. So, you know,
what are the European regulators most worried about?
Well, I mean, you know, of course, we all know that AI is not one thing. There's many things when it comes to AI. And so they've looked really at certain applications of the technology, like, for example, live facial recognition, where they were going to, I believe, outlaw it entirely and decided in the end to have some sort of carve outs for security and law enforcement, which was controversial in itself, because actually some of the most egregious uses of live facial recognition we've seen has been in law enforcement, where we know in the States a number of people have been falsely accused and arrested because they were misidentified by facial recognition.
Larry, what's the debate in the States? What shape of regulation do we see being talked about there?
Right now, what's going on is that there's an inability in the United States to pass anything that looks like legislation. President Biden has put out an executive order. The major interest has been, by the way, I should say, in terms of cybersecurity and defense. They put out in October of 2023, what's called in the U.S. an executive order, which is done by the president in terms of being head of the executive branch, the bureaucracy. And they're trying to get every bureaucratic agency, every major agency, to come up with its own AI policies, with certain agencies being given extra importance. At the same time, Biden has used a piece of legislation from, of all things, 1950 and the Cold War to justify some of what he is doing. There is a good chance that will go down in the courts in the next year or two. And if Trump were to win the election, there's a good chance it will be starting all over again. So again, the emphasis has been largely on cybersecurity, to some degree on some of the commercial issues, particularly working with some of the large language models. The other underlying issue here and where things may split apart is there's also a good deal of interest, worry, et cetera, about election security. And there, the Democratic Party and the Republican Party are at odds with each other, which may make even funding of these programs difficult.
Gina, how do you see all these different regulatory approaches developing? Are there going to be common themes? Is the world going to come across a template for regulating AI?
Well, I think there's going to be several templates. The Americans have just done what the Americans do best, which is with the executive order on AI, they have asserted soft power in the global stage. The symbolic power of that executive order coming on the eve of the global AI safety summit that the UK held cannot be underestimated. That executive order really set the tone in terms of the Americans saying, we need to make sure that social harms are on the table. We need to make sure that the impact on businesses, on workers, on citizens, on consumers is considered in addition to the risks that the UK was rallying a set of players around in their October summit that the UK hosted. I think what we're seeing is, in a simplistic way, you can say that the EU has taken a strong regulatory approach that is risk-based, that looks at and manages these risks along a spectrum. The UK has said that their approach is one that is measured and proportionate and works with existing regulation. And the US, well, the U.S. and regulation don't necessarily go synonymous, but, you know, as Lawrence pointed out, we really have this power within the U.S. to have that work happen within the agencies and within the regulators in terms of add-on regulation. So it's going to be how that plays out in practice in the courts and how that plays out kind of case by case in the U.S. approach. I think what that means for the U.K. is that we have a situation where the UK has said, well, we're going to wait and see, and we're going to use existing law and regulation to apply to this particular emerging set of problems that AI poses. A team that I convened of stakeholders across the UK from business, unions, academia, from the tech industry, from human resources professionals, we sat down and said, well, what would this mean for employment law? So if we take what we know about AI today, what kinds of definitions do we need? How would we stitch this together in the UK approach to regulation? And the short answer is there's a lot of work that's going to have to be done around basic definitions, around figuring out how we move forward so that we have that proportionate approach with the laws that we have and that the kinds of risks people are protected from today continue in an AI world.
Now, obviously, the fear is that this kind of regulation can stifle innovation. How coherently is that case being put, and is it credible?
Well, I think you have to have those rules in place. You have to have a regulatory landscape where people understand the rules before companies are willing to make the investment. So I've been talking to a lot of large players in the adoption space, so big companies who are looking at how they might integrate generative AI and other kinds of AI ML products and services into the work that they offer. And the thing that they're worried about is, how do we understand the risk parameters that are shifting underneath our feet? And companies can't make those investments until they get those clear answers. So for example, our team, along with the Bennett Institute and AI at CAM, released a report in October that looked at what UK policy around generative AI should be. And we make the argument that once you have that clarity, that regulatory clarity, you can really spark the application level and additive level of innovation that the UK can be a leader in, but you're not going to get there with a throwing up your hands approach.
Verity, how do you see this sort of battle over the level of regulation in terms of the threat that it will bring everything to a halt in terms of very useful innovation?
Yes, I mean, and I do agree with Gina that the fact of regulation sometimes is good for innovation. And sometimes there seem to be sort of one side or the other when actually they can work in tandem quite well. So in my book that has just come out, I've written about this example of the regulation of IVF in the UK. IVF being in vitro fertilization and also human embryology research, something which at the time of the first IVF birth in 1978 was incredibly controversial, actually. After some initial excitement, people started to worry about what it might mean. And when this was combined with understanding of research happening on embryos, there was some public concern, if not outrage. And in the end, over a long period of time, and I won't tell the whole story here, you can read the book for that, but there was some really innovative and flexible regulation brought in, which essentially introduced something called the 14-day rule, a cutoff point where research on human embryos could take place on those that were less than 14 days and not any anything past 14 days, which was actually an arbitrary limit. There wasn't really solid scientific evidence for why 14 days, but it was something that the people putting the regulation together, and this is led by Baroness Mary Warnock, felt was needed to sort of assuage public fear while allowing science to flourish. And the UK now has a very high growth life sciences industry, and we've able to see incredible scientific advancement in, you know, biotech and genetic studies and so on, but with those kind of limits. In that case, you know, I think you can make a very solid argument that regulation can support innovation, but of course it needs to be done thoughtfully. And with something as sort of dynamic as AI, it does need to be done in a way that allows for maximum flexibility to update as we go, which, you know, is hard in a legislative process. And I think something I observe about today versus maybe in the past is we seem very keen to have regulation very quickly instead of being willing to sort of wait. And, you know, I understand that impetus, but it might be that there's not a solution to every single thing.
You mentioned healthcare. Let's zero in on that, because there's a huge excitement that AI can do amazing things in terms of diagnosis, drug discovery, and so on. Larry, at the same time, there's a huge panic in some ways over privacy. Is that going to get in the way of transformative solutions like we are promised in healthcare?
I think it really depends, as was pointed out, in terms of how the regulation is done. There are certainly ways we could easily imagine keeping privacy of patients, et cetera, reserved in ways which AI could really allow healthcare to flourish and greatly diminish the cost of healthcare and expand its use. It will depend on how heavy-handed the regulation is. And as we were pointing out, this is a very early time in regulation. We'll have to see how this is actually implemented.
Gina, what's your take on this? We're hearing a lot about the negative side of AI, but there is huge excitement, is there not, over areas like health and climate change, the contribution it should give, and worries that regulation will bring that to a halt.
Listen, privacy is one of those factors that we need to be careful and considered about. But there are others that I think are just as important. I want to underscore, Rory, you're absolutely right. I mean, we are looking at extraordinary potential and opportunities to come from new ways of understanding our world, ourselves, our communities. And that comes with significant, extraordinary power. I think the challenge we have is, how are we using that power? Are we going to use that power to benefit people, or are we going to use that power to enrich a very few American companies? In healthcare, for example, if we look at how we're empowering frontline healthcare workers with tools they need to understand the problems and challenges in front of them of their patients in direct patient care, we see that AI ML solutions can you know, supercharge, amplify the work of those frontline care providers. For example, Duke University Hospitals have an amazing internal data team, and they created an ML-enabled tool for early detection of sepsis. Sepsis is terrible. It's a killer. And to put this tool in the hands of their frontline care team, they realized they had to do one significant thing. They had to make sure they did not tell the nursing staff that it was an AI-enabled tool. Why? Because as soon as they said it was AI, the nursing staff would turn off their own clinical judgment and say, oh, the tool says this patient is at risk of sepsis. We're going to trust this. Or, oh, the tool says that patient isn't. We're going to trust the tool. They forgot that the tool is connected to a whole ecosystem of actions. And so that's the capability we need to really be doubling down on. And it's the capability that the large tech companies aren't good at. They're good at delivering the solutions. They're good at delivering these very large models we've been talking about. They're good at delivering the tech. They're not so good at making sure we upskill workforce, that we make sure that people understand the tools they're working with, and that we have decision makers in place in organizations ready to make sure that they're using the tools to benefit the people that they work with and deliver the products, services, and care that will help, say, in healthcare, help to advance those benefits for everyone.
Verity, you've worked across both politics and you've worked for tech giant Google for some time. Those executives in those tech giants ready to make those sort of quite complex judgments about how they design these tools and how they're implemented that Gina's just outlined there?
Well, you know, my experience inside Google and DeepMind is that executives and teams there were incredibly thoughtful and knowledgeable about the risks. And at DeepMind, I was one of the early employees. I was the first global head of policy there, and I co-founded all of their ethics and society research teams and work. So, you know, we were thinking about those kinds of issues from a very early stage. But I think it's important to delineate what is the responsibility of the private companies and what is the responsibility of the governments and the regulators and sort of our democratic representatives. And the reason I first left politics to go into technology is because I felt that there was this sort of democratic deficit where people building the technology knew loads more about it than the people who were supposed to be either regulating it or just sort of having oversight and accountability of it on behalf of their citizens. And I felt that just the information sharing wasn't there. I think that's a lot better today than it was back then. And there's a lot more sort of open discussion, as you say, rightly happening at an earlier stage with AI between politicians and the technology companies. But there's no doubt that there is a imbalance in resourcing, but it's sort of not an excuse for governments to sort of step away and outsource the responsibilities to the tech companies either.
Let's have a look at a couple of other areas where there are potential dangers. Democracy, how AI is threatening elections. Larry, this is obviously a huge year for elections around the world. Are governments ready to manage these AI threats and the potential risks of misinformation and so on?
To be honest, I don't think they are. As was pointed out, does government have the capacity to really do this? If you actually look at, for example, the budgets that are being allocated in the UK or the US, they're fairly minuscule. In the US, election security is fractured and federalized. And the other thing that AI could do is you can have a very quick AI attack. I mean, often things like government reactions and the application of regulations takes time. And you could imagine having a large impact on an election in a very short time. I know of all places in Slovakia, that was something that happened where right before the election, AI got involved and there were issues there. In the US, it would not shock me if there are some November surprises. For those who don't know, our elections are somewhere between November 2nd and 8th every 4 years for the presidency. So that's why we use the term November surprise, that you could easily imagine a variety of efforts by people using AI that would just put mass confusion into the election. I think it's a very scary possibility.
Yeah, I just want to flag something I don't disagree, but I think it's important to remember that it is people making these decisions, so it's not that AI gets involved in the election. It's that whoever the hostile actors might be choose to use AI tools to try and interfere. And so we've seen that that has happened to varying degrees of success already without AI. And the question really is it going to make it easier to do that or not? And from what I've seen, I'm no expert in disinformation, but from what I've seen from those who are, there's sort of not a settled consensus on whether AI is going to make it a lot worse than it already is. Thomas Ridd has a fantastic book out about the sort of the history of disinformation. And he said, the rise of internet troll farms in Russia, for example, maybe created more noise, but not necessarily more effective sort of operations. However, there's a very interesting article that Professor Alondra Nelson and Dr. Julia Angwin said their concern is people are going to assume that generative tools like ChatGPT are information sources. And they're going to go to them and ask ChatGPT information about, for example, where do I vote and how do I vote? And what we know from those types of tools, ChatGPT, and there are many others, they do this thing called hallucination. I don't like that term because it makes it sound like a human being, but they get things wrong. And we're not very sophisticated in using them yet. So again, that's kind of people using these new tools rather than the new tools themselves. I mean, I do just want to caution that this is a kind of interaction between people and new technology rather than always just the new technology.
Right. Of course, that's true. But this might be a matter of degree. That's all. That might be a different level than in previous times.
Let's move on to another danger, or one much discussed, is the impact on jobs of AI, how it will change the quantity and quality of jobs, and what policymakers can do about that. Gina, I think that's one of your specialist subjects. We've seen sort of waves of pessimism. I remember about 10 years ago, there was a report saying half of all jobs were under threat in the United States, and those numbers have come rapidly down. Are you one of those who've become more optimistic that this transition can be managed effectively?
I've become very pragmatic that we have a lot of work to do. So the best economic estimates that we have today from OECD, the International Labor Organization, and others suggest that what we'll see is a net overall gain in employment from AI, but that there will be many jobs affected. And if you read carefully when you see the news reports about AI and jobs, AI and employment, you see people talking about the tasks changing, that jobs will change. It won't necessarily eliminate jobs. So consider the work of a professor, for example. We may see enormous changes in how we do assessment, how we mark assessments, how we interact with students, but the role of delivering education probably won't go away. Similarly, we see across many kinds of industries that people are going to need new and different skills. My team 2 years ago did a report with OECD, the Inter-America Development Bank, and UNESCO around how new AI tools were impacting women's work. And we took a lens that was outside of the global north to really think through where in the entire life cycle of employment are we seeing these challenges. So the short answer to that report was literally, we have capacity building to do. We need to help get lifelong learning schemes in place in more countries. We need to make sure that new technologies are not exacerbating existing social inequalities, especially at work. And we've got some real fundamental capacity building to do in our organizations to make sure that workers are empowered to use new tools and given the creativity and the education to make sure they're using them safely and responsibly so that they can increase their productivity rather than simply shut it down and say these tools are going to take everybody's jobs. That's not the consensus now of what we think is going to happen to employment on a large scale.
Larry, it's always a very hot political topic, the threats to jobs in this way. But is there anything regulators can do about it?
It will be less regulation in the classical sense than politicians. There's a couple of interesting features of this, at least assuming we believe the various crystal balls. For example, Daron Acemoglu, among others, who's a very, very famous economist about development, said what AI will do will increase the economy, which everything being equal is good, and it will also increase inequality in industrial countries. One issue will be with increased inequality in particular, what that really seems to mean is making certain white-collar positions less valuable than they used to be. It can create political upheaval, and perhaps one response will be that these people will in one way either have to be retrained or paid off. And there is so much inequality in the industrial world already that that additional inequality, particularly to a group that we could imagine being more politically mobilized than some losers in past innovations, could create a great deal of political upheaval.
Verity, in your new book, which you've mentioned, but you've not mentioned the title. I'm going to mention the title, AI Needs You, How We Can Change AI's Future and Save Our Own. It's an excellent book. You highlight the need for more people to get involved in the whole AI conversation. What kind of expertise do we need to bring in and how can more people get involved?
We need all kinds of expertise. I mean, if AI really is going to be this pervasive, transformative technology that hits all areas of society, then all areas of society have the right to have a say and an opinion about it. And what I've tried to do with the book is break down some of the gatekeeping that often happens around technology and AI policy that says something like, if you don't understand the technology itself, then you don't understand what you're talking about and therefore, shouldn't really have a say. I don't think you need to be able to understand the deep technical details to have an opinion about how people should be treated and what sort of society you want to live in and whether AI sort of supports that or it doesn't. Gina talked about workers getting involved in what the future of their work will look like. And indeed, some of the people most qualified to talk about AI are the people already being affected by AI in their workplace, drivers, delivery drivers who are being monitored the whole time that they're working by facial recognition and sensors and other AI tools, for example, people on the sharp end of outsourced automated decision making because there are cost cutting measures in place. There really is a place for everybody to have a say and to have a role in this. And in my book, which you kindly mentioned, when I talk about that IVF example and the way that that was developed, that was an interdisciplinary sort of independent commission. And it had a philosopher leading it, had biologists on there, of course, but it had some people from religious backgrounds, it had social workers on there, legal experts. And, and I really think that's the type of interdisciplinary, multi-stakeholder work that needs to happen to get to a, solution for AI in the public interest.
Of course, the other question is global collaboration. I mean, it's quite difficult, is it not, Larry, to see the United States and China collaborating on regulating AI when they are in a fight to the death to dominate it?
Well, this will be one of the key issues. As I said, I mean, I think the major players will in some sense want to have a playing field across various markets. And we've had that, for example, in international trade, where despite the fact that the US and China at our loggerheads, they're both parts of the World Trade Organization and in some sense try to work together in those things as they both realize the value of international trade. Sometimes those things get bogged down by parochial political considerations and the like. So it will be very, very interesting to see how these relationships with China do unfold over time. Partly it will depend on the unique political situations in those countries, how they evolve as well, and who the leaders are, particularly in the United States.
I want to bring this all together by asking, what will good AI regulation look like? What will ensure that it works for us and improve people's living and working conditions? Gina.
Well, I worked with a group of stakeholders from industry, from trade unions, from human resource professionals, from the tech firms, to basically look at what an AI and employment bill for the UK would look like. And what good AI will look like is getting a wide and diverse group of stakeholders sitting down together and saying, this is what we want our future to look like. And making sure that that future fits with the laws and regulations that we have. So next month in April, we will be launching a campaign around what would an AI and employment bill look like for the UK. When you start to get into the nitty-gritty, as Verity and Larry have done, when you get into the nitty-gritty of the tech and the law, you realize there's a lot of work to be done and there are a lot of conversations that we need to be having about the futures we want.
Larry, I mean, one of the problems, of course, is regulators are always going to be a bit behind the galloping pace of AI, but what would your recipe for good regulation look like?
I think one thing I would add to what's been said is there's got to be a push to make this a more or less global regulation. The way we try to deal with trade, the way we deal with some other things like computers and industrial chemicals and all sorts of things, that I don't think that having a UK-specific or an American-specific policy or an EU-specific policy without real integration between those regulatory policies is going to work. And it may take a while to get there, but I think the firms themselves, at least the major players, are going to push to that. As you said, then the other thing is, how do you navigate the capacity issues? And again, the more you're perhaps on a global level, the more the capacity might, and I underline might, be more comparable to what the firms have, so that at least if you say, show me what you're doing, there's an ability to recognize the implications of what the firms are doing. So I think those are going to be the fundamental things. I do not believe this is something that America, the EU, the UK can do on its own.
Verity, you spent a long time thinking about this. Have you come up with a template?
Well, I don't have a template, but I do think increasingly that the answer to this is that good AI regulation will look like something that is intentional. And by that, I mean, we have thought about the type of society that we want. And this is, you know, really political leadership we need here as much as tech leadership. We have decided that we either do or don't want to be in a more pervasive surveillance culture. We have decided that we do want to support people to live fulfilling and dignified lives that includes good employment. You know, we have decided that we want to see people treated fairly and equally. And they might sound sort of like lofty ambitions, but actually, I think the longer I've spent thinking about AI, it's more important that we start from there. I fear that where we've got to in the past couple of years is starting from a position that says, well, this technology is coming, how do we make it the least worst it can possibly be? Instead of saying, you know, how can we use this technology to really advance and bring sort of progress and, you know, better futures for us all? And if we start from that premise, I think it's slightly easier, though not easy, to get good regulation in place.
Well, that's all we've got time for on this episode. Thanks to Verity Harding from the Bennett Institute, Gina Neff from the University of Cambridge, and Lawrence Rothenberg from the IAST and the University of Rochester. Let us know what you think of this latest episode of Season 3 of Crossing Channels. You can contact us via Twitter, as I still insist on calling it. The Bennett Institute is at Bennett Inst. The Institute for Advanced Study in Toulouse is IAS Toulouse. And I am Ruskin147. If you enjoyed this episode, then do listen to our other Crossing Channels editions, notably our latest on gender inequalities at the workplace. And please join us next month for the next edition, where we'll be looking at the role of protests and civic activism.